found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Start your workday off right with the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
And good morning. A special thanks to Linda O'Brien, girlfriend and voiceover artist extraordinaire. She does the intros to our shows and the outros, and she's a true pro. She has a studio at home. She also voice tracks for Dial Global and an amazing talent. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. If you're listening live, thank you so much for joining us. It's 9:01 on Monday, May 6th, day after Cinco de Mayo, which the Sanchez, you might wonder, where does that come from? What's my mother's name. I was raised Da Sanchez growing up and started a career with my father's name, my maiden name. And then when I got divorced, I decided I didn't want to keep my ex's last name. And I didn't necessarily want to go back to my father's name. So I had used Maria Sanchez as my nom de plume when I started my master's in theater arts with an emphasis on script writing. And I used to call her my creative alter ego. So with the dissolution of the marriage, there's a box you can check that asks what name to go back to, and so I chose to go full-time legally with Maria Sanchez. And she's been with me ever since. That's been about 19 years ago legally, so that's the genesis of the name. But it's my mom's family name, which they are from the Basque region of Spain, very separatist, very independent folks, although she was raised in the United States. She didn't speak English until she went to the first grade. Same with my dad. He was raised in Chicago with he's the first generation American. His folks came through Ellis Island, and they did not speak much English. They spoke, well, actually when I was growing up, but with fairly thick accents. My grandparents, my oma and opa on my dad's side. But my dad and my mother both speak English as their second language. Went to, the first they spoke English was when they went to first grade. And, you know, this is America, and so we speak English here. And my mom even said that there were little cop kids that if you were caught talking Spanish on the playgrounds, you were turned in and reported. So my folks are not very sympathetic to English as a second language and mollycoddling, as they call it, kids who come here and don't speak English. They're like, you know what, we did it, you can do it. Consequently, they didn't teach us their mother tongues because they said they were discriminated against and prejudiced against so much that they didn't want to inflict that upon us. So instead of being trilingual, we are speak English. I used to be somewhat bilingual, comprendo más que hablar. I minored in Spanish in college. I was fairly conversant in Spanish as a young, you know, 20-something, actually probably, I don't know, for 20 years or so. And then I fulfilled a lifelong promise to myself, which was I wanted to be completely bilingual. So I enrolled in a super intensive language immersion class in Madrid, Spain, and thought, when I get back, I'm going to finally have just, you know, put myself over the edge. Because my vocabulary I've got, it's just that I kind of stop and think about the conjugation, which makes it not automatic. So that was a big mistake, because they speak Castilian in Madrid. And so I had to unlearn all my California Spanish, which is Mexican influenced, because they used to say to me in school, you sound like you come from Mexico, and I said, that's because I come from California, and that's the language that we speak, or those are the accents, and this is the vocabulary that we use. And so there I am, undoing that I had known for decades, and relearning in 4 weeks' time, so it just put me even further back behind the curve. So I consider myself Hispanic. There are other people in this world that is half something, and they get to claim that path, and that's what I do. So I consider myself Spanish, thus the Maria Sanchez. I do have a brother, Carlos, too, by the way, so it's not like I'm the only one with that name. We've got on the program this morning, we are going to have the public information officer for the Ventura County Fire Department talk to us about the Springs fire, which should have containment today. We made national news with that fire. Then we are going to be speaking with the CEO of the American Red Cross to talk about what the American Red Cross did when the folks were being evacuated and the three shelters that they opened up. Then we're speaking at the bottom of the hour with our Word of the Month correspondent. He's a lexicographer. Lexicographer. He'll tell us how to say that, which means he's editor at large with Merriam-Webster.com. I happen to love words, but even if you don't, it's fascinating what Peter shares with. He's been a correspondent with us for, I think, 8 years or something. Anyway, what he does, he's going to tell us about Merriam-Webster.com, how many hits they get a month. It's staggering. It's in the millions. And then what are the top 10 words that were searched and why and what the definition is. So he visits with us at the beginning of the month to talk about the prior month's searches and what people were. So oftentimes it comes about because somebody makes a speech and uses a word that is uncommon, or somebody in the media uses something and it catches fire, that sort of thing, goes viral, if you will. So he's going to share that with us at the bottom of the hour. The top five stories that you need to know about that the uncle of the bombing suspect, Tamerlane Tsarnaev, has claimed the body, and it's in a funeral home, and he went yesterday with three of his friends, and they prepared to wash and shroud his body according to Muslim tradition. The guy's getting a fair amount of heat because they're saying that some folks have accused him of being un-American, and he says, I'm just performing the tradition for my nephew. I'm dealing with logistics. A dead person must be buried. These are my friends who feel for me, as I do understand no one wants to associate their names with such evil events. So he's distancing himself from what they've done. He says it's heinous. It's brought shame to his family, to the Chechnyans, and to Muslims. And but they have to do something about it. The problem is there's nowhere to bury him at the moment. Nobody's wanting to put the body in the ground. So that's still going on. The story continues to unfold. And then one of the three that was arrested last week is going to before a judge today. They're saying that they might release him and to, you know, not keep him incarcerated any longer because he's not a flight risk. Jurors are deliberating today for the first full day in the Jody Arias murder trial. They're also deliberating for the fourth full day in the Philadelphia trial of Dr. Gosnell. He's 72, charged with killing four babies allegedly born alive at his clinic in West Philadelphia. He's also charged in the 2009 overdose death of a patient, a 41-year-old mother of three. I was talking with a girlfriend over the weekend, actually yesterday, we went on a two-hour hike, and she had worked at Planned Parenthood, and I don't know if Planned Parenthood or it was a clinician that she worked with in Washington that would perform abortions up to 22 weeks. And I guess Gosnell is accused of 24 weeks and further. But I said, so how do you decide if a fetus is 20 weeks or 22 weeks or what have you? And she says they do ultrasound. And she used some term like top of head to butt or something. They measure it. And then she went on to describe the procedure, the late term abortion procedures, that it's a two-day process, and you have to, her physician injected something into the fetus that would kill the fetus, but then you've got this body that has to be expelled. And so she said then the patient would go home, and then I guess you start to dilate a little bit, and then you come back the next day, and they have the cervix, they make it get larger by using instruments. It's not a speculum, it's something else. And then, they go in and start taking out parts. So it was not a very pleasant conversation because she made an interesting point, though. She said to me, I am not pro-abortion. I'm pro-choice. And I was like, that's an interesting distinction there. Being raised Roman Catholic, I was always influenced with the right to life and pro-life and all that sort of thing. And now as I've gotten older, I think that abortion is murder, but I believe that a woman should be entitled to make that decision about herself and her body. So we might be talking semantics here, but so that's in the story, the news today, too. Excuse me. Swallowed my own saliva. The Senate is probably going to vote today to charge sales tax to require sales tax to be charged to online retailers. And they're saying that the estimates are that it could generate more than $12 billion in additional sales tax. And 30% of online shoppers surveyed said that they would shop more at brick-and-mortar retails if the tax became a reality. Amazon.com is supporting the bill. The company is already collecting sales tax in 9 of the states where it has warehouses. And eBay has been opposing the tax. He's asking, the CEO, John Donahue, is asking for a broader exemption. Because right now the law would only apply, if it's passed in the Senate, then of course it has to go to the House, would only apply to online sellers that have sales tax of at least $1 million in states where they don't have physical operations. And the CEO of eBay is asking, he says, we believe small businesses with less than 50 employees or less than $10 million in annual out-of-state sales should be exempt from the burden of collecting sales tax nationwide. And then a real tragic story that happened here in California over the weekend. A bride-to-be was among five who died after the limo from her bachelorette party burst into flames. And so four women were injured and five perished. She was 31 years old, a nurse from Fresno. She was due to be married next month. She had been celebrating with 9 friends. I believe they say all the gals were nurses. They think the fire started in the trunk. The driver stopped the vehicle when he noticed the fire. He was able to get four women out, but the five, including the bride-to-be, were trapped in the back and died. They were so badly burned that they had to be identified by dental records. And she was a nurse at the Community Regional Medical Center, and apparently they were returning from a bachelorette party whereupon they were going to be meeting up with the groom. So you can only imagine the devastation. And our hearts go out to her and her family and her fiancé. What just horrible. They're saying it's a small study, but they're saying that forget sterilizing. If your child's pacifier needs to be cleaned, suck on it. And why? Because toddlers are less likely to have asthma and itchy rashes, i.e. eczema, if their parents cleaned their pacifiers by sucking on them when the kids were infants. And why is that? My kids never did pacifiers. They were digit suckers, which people say, well, you can take the pacifier away, but you can't take the thumb or the fingers. But my kids, some of them had to have a cage to stop it when they got a little bit older, but otherwise they were able to take care of themselves. They're saying that the transfer of mouth microbes from the parents to the baby may help boost the bacterial diversity of the young child's digestive system and foster immunity. So here's something else that the study was referencing, that babies being delivered vaginally are exposed to more of their mom's bacteria, and that's been linked to fewer allergies in childhood. So the study this was done in a Swedish hospital, and it was a small study, so you got to keep that in mind. But they said that they followed up these families for 3 years, and that the group of infants that they followed, which was 184, were particularly allergy prone. 80% had at least one parent with allergies. So kids whose pacifiers had been sucked on by parents were 63% less likely to have eczema at 18 months, and 88% less likely to have asthma compared to the children of parents who didn't use the cleaning technique of sucking on the pacifier. And then Chris Christie is in the news, and he's got PETA upset because of something that he did in front of fourth grade class. So we will get to that when we have time, excuse me. But now we're going to be speaking with Bill Nash. He is the public information officer for the Ventura County Fire Department. And we're going to speak about the Springs fire.
Information, this is Bill.
Hi, Bill. Good morning. It's Maria Sanchez. You're live on the Maria Sanchez Show.
Good morning.
Good morning, Bill. You've had quite the week and weekend, have you not?
Yes, it's been a busy week for firefighters from throughout the state who have come here into Ventura County to help us fight the Springs fire.
And can you give us a recap? I know 28,000 acres were affected, and where are you with containment and personnel?
Well, we're pleased that the acreage amount is holding at 28,000 acres. We don't expect it to extend much beyond that, although there may be a little finger or two that pokes out from that. But that 28,000 acre figure seems accurate for now. We're at 80% containment, and we're expecting full containment tomorrow.
So 80% at this moment in time and 100% tomorrow.
That's right.
And obviously the rain helped a lot.
Well, the rain was welcome, but the real work was done by the firefighters, not the rain. They've been working literally day and night throughout the last 4 days to get a line around this fire, and certainly the weather helped by slowing down the rate of spread. The wind dropped down, the humidity came up, and that helped. But the real credit for this goes to the firefighters.
Can you explain what drawing a ring around it means physically?
Sure. Well, what we want to do is to stop the forward spread of this fire. To do that, we need to make sure that we have a containment line around 100% of it. And that's what we call containment, and that's usually what we're talking about when we're updating the public and the media. What happens after we get that 100% containment is then we can start working in from that containment line and making sure that everything within the containment line is out. Once we've worked into the center of the fire and everything is out and cold, we call the fire controlled.
Controlled. So interesting. I thought the containment meant that it was out, but containment means that you've encircled it and then you can work within.
That's right. We've got the fire corralled at that point, and now we can work towards the middle to make sure everything in the middle of that containment line is out.
Now, what's happening with mutual aid?
I'm sorry, my phone buzzed and you were cut off.
Oh, mutual aid. How is that going? And are you going to be deploying, or what do you call that, where you let them go?
We've actually had thousands of firefighters from across California come in to assist us on this. It's one of the nice things about the fire service in California is that there's a lot of teamwork. When one jurisdiction needs help, they get help from many others, and that was certainly the case here. Fortunately, with the containment where it is and the weather doing what it's doing, we're able to send some of those people home, and that actually started last night. More will be demobilized today, and over the next few days, we'll try and get all those people back to their families.
Demobilized, that's the word I was looking for. Now, Bill, how is it and what requires CAL FIRE to get involved, as they were with the Springs fire?
Well, it usually depends on where the fire is located. In this case, the fire started on what's called state responsibility area land, and that is CAL FIRE's jurisdiction. Ventura County is a contract county with CAL FIRE, meaning that in Ventura County, there are no CAL FIRE fire stations. They pay us to have fire stations to cover those areas for them. So as this fire grew, they came in with an incident management team to run the fire. Had this occurred on United States land, it would have been a federal management team that came in.
And so once CAL FIRE comes in and incident command takes over, then they're at the top, if you will, of the pecking order in terms of disseminating information?
Information and perhaps more importantly, money.
Oh, okay. Because then was it CAL funds that were made available or federal funds?
This kind of a fire is paid for out of CAL FIRE's emergency funds. This is why they have those funds, because we know we're going to have a number of fires every year. And so these kinds of fires are budgeted for.
And then do you have a cause?
The investigators have determined the point of origin, which was on Highway 101, just north of the Trex Hills on the Canadian Hill Grade, but they have not been able to determine a cause, just too much fire damage. And the one thing they did say is even though the cause is undetermined, there was nothing to indicate that it was suspicious in any way.
Good. So that's good to know. And anything else that you want to add? The life of a PIO for a fire agency that was made national news?
Well, mostly what we're happy about is that the firefighters stayed safe. We only had 8 minor injuries in this huge, fast-moving, furious fire. And better than that even is the fact that nobody's home was lost.
Yes.
The firefighters at one point had 4,000 homes threatened, including mine, and they were able to save every one of them.
Yeah, and I saw your post on Facebook with Holly taking pictures, Bill's wife, Holly, and then you dealing with the media and your house being threatened. That emotionally, that had to be scary.
Well, it's a little unusual being live on the air, watching helicopter coverage of your own house. But you know, I was pleased because there was a bright yellow fire engine in front of my house, and our firefighters are the best. And I knew with our guys there that my house was going to be fine.
Well, and as I sent you the text on Friday, Piers Morgan had a reporter from Southern California on the scene in Newbury Park, and she was interviewing folks who they had evacuated, and then they came back, and they gave the Ventura County Fire Department props, which was really nice to hear.
It really is. Our firefighters train very hard, and we do a lot of pre-planning for just this kind of an eventuality. And so when it happens, we're ready for it.
Excellent. Well, Bill, thank you for taking the time to visit with us. I do appreciate it. I know you've got a lot of demands on your desk. So say hi to Holly for me, too, please.
Thank you, Maria. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Take care. That's Bill Nash, and he is the public information officer for the Ventura County Fire Department, and he is we've been PIOs together, so it's fun in that regard. So your little friend here is going to make our next call, and that is going to be to our guest, who's going to be Jim McGee with call. Excuse me, as I learn my way through this equipment here. Okay. Sam gave me a shortcut, and it's not working, but I'm going to do it now. Here we go. So Jim is the CEO of the American Red Cross, and they were partnered in this event, and so we're visiting with Jim to talk about what happened with the American Red Cross and the three shelters that they established. And Maria is making, she is calling. Okay. Yeah, eight. Here we go. There we go. Thank you for bearing with us. This is called Raw Internet Radio, the Maria Sanchez Show.
Hi, it's Jim.
Good morning, Jim. It's Maria Sanchez. You're live on the air. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Maria.
You're welcome. Jim McGee, the CEO of the American Red Cross, and the territory or region is called what now that you oversee?
It's Central Coast. Maria, which includes Ventura County.
Central Coast. And Jim, can you let our listeners know what role the American Red Cross played in the Springs fire, please?
Of course, yeah. We're honored to be able to be there for our community in times of disaster this last week. Side by side with our first responders, we set up a variety of shelters throughout the county where people that were impacted by the fire could come and have a place to stay, shelter, food, and then also any emotional support or counseling that they may need to get them through the week.
And how do people avail themselves of it? They just show up?
Yeah, I think along with our first responders, we did a good job communicating where the Red Cross shelters were throughout the county. And our friends and the family would show up and they'd check in, and we'd make sure that we had trained volunteers working with, these clients to make sure they were taken care of.
And can you let us know how it is that you're able to avail the public of these services, and are there charges involved?
No, there are no charges involved. All of the Red Cross services are free, and we can only provide those services free because of the amazing generosity of our donors. The Red Cross is congressionally chartered to provide mass care, which means whenever there's a disaster, the Red Cross is congressionally chartered to be there to provide services, yet we rely 100% on the local financial support of Ventura County to be the best Red Cross we can be in this community.
So people might think that because of the congressional charter, that the American Red Cross is a government agency.
Correct, and that's an oftentimes misperception. No, we are not a government agency. We are a public agency relying on the support of the public.
And so I would imagine that now when people donate, they donate either for something that's happened, which you're either replenishing your coffers or you're getting it there for the next disaster, because you have to be aware that something else may happen. Ventura County has the dubious distinction of being one of the most disaster-prone counties in the country.
Well, absolutely, and yeah, Marie, you know this as well as anyone. We do live in, although a beautiful area, a very high kind of risk area. And we rely on, you know, donors that give 365 days a year, and then we also have had some amazing donors step up over the last few days and give to help us, you know, fund the cost of this local operation, Ring Fire.
So, if somebody's never had, if they've had the good fortune to never avail themselves of a shelter, what does that look like? What does it mean? Do you erect a tent? Do you use buildings already in existence?
Sure. Yeah, I think we do both, and it really depends on the situation and what is needed. And we work very closely with Ventura County Sheriff and the Office of Emergency Services to make sure that we're setting up the right shelter in the right place with the right services. But, you know, for example, our Camarillo shelter, we had a partnership with one of the local churches, Camarillo Nexus, and they allowed us to use their facility, and we were able to bring in cots and blankets and food and our trained volunteers. And in a great partnership, we were able to provide those Red Cross services to our community. In other instances, we may set up a mobile tent where we have tents and we're able to care for up to 100 people for a number of days if that is the particular need.
And can you say how many clients that you serviced with the three shelters that you opened?
Yeah, I think our high count was 100 clients. I believe that was Friday afternoon. And then we had, but we had clients in all of our three shelters throughout the weekend.
And are they still open or no?
No, as of Saturday at 4 o'clock, we did close our two Ventura County shelters, and Sunday morning we closed our Malibu shelter. And currently, you know, the Red Cross continues to assist. We have our trained client caseworkers that are going out and reaching out to those homeowners in the impacted areas to make sure that they are aware of the additional Red Cross services that we can provide. That includes either financial assistance, if certain circumstances are met, or just general preparedness information. If anything, this recent spring fire is a great reminder that each of us, whether we live here, work here, go to school here, need to be prepared.
And what website do you want to share, Jim?
The best website with quite a bit of great free information is redcross.org. And I'm also going to encourage our smartphone users to download our wildfire smartphone application, and you can find that for free either in the iTunes store or at Google Play.
Google Play. Cool. And what does that entail? Is it advice?
For our smartphone app, it's all about, you know, putting, you know, really meaningful resources in the hands of our community. So all the resources that are found at our website, much of that is now available on a smartphone application. And what is, I think, most relevant these days is the ability to connect out to your social media friends through Facebook and Twitter, letting people know that you're safe during a time of disaster.
And can you still register online to do that, or are you encouraging the smartphone application instead?
We're encouraging people to use smartphone application. If you're referring to our Safe and Well website,
yes,
that is still available at redcross.org.
And do you want to give just a brief summary of what that is, Safe and Well?
Yeah, Safe and Well is a website that allows those people that are impacted by a disaster to register and let people know that they're safe. And then those people that are trying to ensure that a family member is safe, they can go to that website and confirm that that family member is safe. And we saw a lot of success recently during Superstorm Sandy, where family members were able to connect through that website, Safe and Well. And that can be, again, found at our redcross.org website.
And finally, Jim, what kind of donations does the American Red Cross solicit?
We solicit financial support from those that are in a position to generously give. And the best way to give is, again, you can click by going to redcross.org, or you can text by going to 90999. And, of course, if you'd like to call, you can go to 877-RED-CROSS. And, again, we rely 100% on our local community support to be able to be the Red Cross.
And can you share what the percentage of donated dollars go to services?
Yeah, we're very proud of our reputation. 91 cents of every dollar goes directly to client services. So That is a great rating for nonprofit charities, and we feel really great about being excellent stewards of our community's dollars.
Which is a fantastic number. So to reiterate, 91 cents out of every donated dollar goes to doing something, not to overhead, not to salaries, not to brick-and-mortar structures. So
correct.
That's an amazing number, Jim. I'm glad to hear that that's still up there. Anything else you'd like to add?
Lastly, I'd just like to thank all of our wonderful volunteers who once again stepped up this week to deliver the wonderful mission of the Red Cross. And we can only be the Red Cross because of the amazing network of volunteers and the amazing generosity of our donors and the partners like you, Maria, who consistently showcase the Red Cross and the work that we do. So thank you.
You're welcome. You're in my heart and in my blood. That's that'll never change. Jim, thank you for your time and continued success.
Thank you, Maria.
You're welcome. That's Jim McGee. He is the CEO of the American Red Cross at the Central Coast. And the American Red Cross obviously is a national organization. And so if you're listening not in Southern California, just log on to redcross.org. You enter in your zip code and they will let you know where there is a chapter nearby so that you too can get involved. Because it's not just the money that's donated that's needed, but as Jim was saying, when you've got somebody in a shelter and they need to be taken care of, it's volunteers that are making that happen because they have to be staffed 24/7. Obviously, we can't let people be at a place without supervision for all kinds of reasons. So I've actually been deployed. I am a spokesperson with the American Red Cross, and I have deployment stories that are really amazing with the donors. And we have on the line Peter Sokolowski. Good afternoon to you, because I know you're on the East Coast. How are you, Peter?
Great to hear your voice, Maria.
Yeah, you too. And Peter, how do you say, is it lexicographer?
That's it. Perfect.
Okay, look it. I'm getting better. Your last name I sometimes still trip over. So Sokolowski?
Yes, but that's not in the dictionary, so you get a pass on that.
So, Peter, let us know first, if you don't mind. I told our listeners that you visit with us every month about the prior month's word searches. But can you talk about Merriam-Webster.com in general and how many hits you get and that sort of thing, and then we'll drill down to April.
Right. I mean, we talk about the dictionary as data now because the dictionary is free. Anyone can look up a word at Merriam-Webster.com. The difference between now and the old days is that now we know what words are being looked up so that we can determine at any given moment which words are being looked up, what's interesting, basically, to the American people.
Mm-hmm.
And the numbers are pretty impressive. Overall, if you combine our websites, we're getting 1.5 billion page views per year. So that's 1 billion with a B. So it's a huge amount of data. And so what we can do is look at the data in the moment, day by day, week by week, month by month, as we do sometimes, and see what people are thinking about according to what words they're looking up. And it does tell an interesting story. And I report on that on Twitter, because Twitter is a perfect place to give information in a timely way.
And you tweet about a word, or you tweet about trends?
Yes.
Or
what I often do is I'll tweet about the word that's being looked up at that very moment. And if it's a kind of intense moment, for example, a presidential debate, or a more sad example, a tragedy of terrorism, I often tweet by the hour to show which words are being looked up in what order according to the hour. That is to say, as the story evolves and as the coverage evolves.
And so people can follow you on Twitter, obviously.
Yes, yeah, and it's a great way. For me, Twitter is a perfect way to give small facts out to the public. And I tweet under my own name, at Peter Sokolowski. And the lookup information is of course, Merriam-Webster's homepage at Merriam-Webster.com.
And give a brief overview, please, to the listeners about your background. I like to call you the Renaissance man because you have quite the educational experience.
Well, it's a fun job. To write a dictionary is kind of like taking the SAT every day in terms of in terms of the concentration and the quiet that's required. So, for example, I'm speaking to you now from a conference room because my colleagues work in a silent office. So we have a big library of an office, but nobody talks out loud for the most part. No, I went to school to be a French professor, and I was teaching French at the University of Massachusetts when I was asked to write a French dictionary. And that was my first project with Merriam-Webster, and I've never gone back. So that was 19 years ago now. And so since that time, because dictionaries take a long time, that work that took 6 years. I then worked on the Collegiate Dictionary, the famous Red Dictionary. And then I worked on our newest dictionary, which is a dictionary for non-native speakers of English, or ESL. We call it the Learner's Dictionary. And because of that book, I've been traveling the world to tell the story of American English and to give workshops and lectures to educators all over the world, people who want to learn more about American English and who want to teach it better.
How fabulous for you and for them, I bet. Because you also studied in Europe, as I recall, did you not?
Yeah, I went to the University of Paris, and I worked hard to learn French as well as I could. My mother's French-Canadian, but when you go to college in France, you really kind of brings you up to speed. And that was a great experience. And now I've given lecture tours for the U.S. State Department about American English in Korea and Brazil and India, and we're looking forward to more.
And when you say the dictionary, do you actually mean physically a book that's bound?
Yes. Often, it depends on the country. When you're talking about, for example, Korea and Japan, those are some of the most plugged-in countries in the world and the Internet. It's funny, when you take the subway in Korea, in Seoul, everybody's looking at their smartphones. They're watching soap operas. Streaming on TV in the subway, which shows you the extent of their connectivity. But other countries, such as India and other places in what you might call the developing world, really are still using dictionaries as print products. And the fact is, we still sell a lot of books. The book is by no means dead as a print product. Although what's interesting about dictionaries is that the dictionary information is presented beautifully, both electronically and as a print traditional dictionary.
And how often should somebody update if they have a book?
I would say every 10 years. You know, the traditional idea for the Collegiate Dictionary, which is the best-selling hardcover book in American history, and you probably all know that. It's been red for the past 30 years. It was blue, dark blue. If you went to high school in the 60s or 70s, you might remember it as a blue book. It's updated with a brand-new edition every decade or so, right? Every 10 or 12 years is a brand new edition. We're currently in the 11th edition. So if your dictionary doesn't say the 11th, then it might be time for a new one, especially since a lot of words have come into the language in the last 10, 15 years, particularly, of course, words that have to do with the Internet, but also words with a reference to foreign food terms, because the world keeps getting smaller. We keep borrowing new kinds of cuisine and borrowing the names to name them.
And do you use colloquial words? How do you decide to add? Like, there was about 5 years ago, the guys used to call themselves baller. And then I read it about in three different articles, and I was like, okay, well, I guess this has been accepted now to call yourself that.
Absolutely. I mean, we do have a label that says informal and one that says slang. And, for example, the word anywho, spelled A-N-Y-H-O-O, has just been added to our unabridged dictionary because it shows up so often in print. And really, the gold standard is still the printed word, that is to say something that's edited to be read by many people. That could be the New York Times, but it could also be Slate online. And so we found that, that gold standard works whether you're talking about a very technical word, for example, a scientific word that might only be used by scientists, but as it suddenly becomes part or gradually becomes part of the everyday language of you and me, then it becomes part of the dictionary. So we added anywho, and let's see, a couple other ones, mashup, slider for the small hamburger, and viral, meaning a way of spreading information quickly across the Internet. These are all terms that we've added in the last couple of years.
Interesting. So I don't want us to run out of time, so do you mind starting with the top 10 for April?
Oh, for April. Well, the way we watch these words now is with the trend watch on our homepage at Merriam-Webster.com, and we give the big word for every week.
Okay.
So I'm going to give you starting actually on March 30th because it's such an interesting word.
Okay.
And the word was bellicose.
Mm-hmm.
And bellicose was used, as you might guess, when North Korea started rattling the saber, and it announced that it was aiming rockets at South Korea, Hawaii, and Guam, an American territory. And this was always described in the press as bellicose rhetoric. You know, so this was the term bellicose, which means favoring or inclined to start quarrels or wars. And of course, it comes from the Latin word that means war, which is bellum. And so bellicose is a great English word that's kind of a formal word, and it's used a lot by journalists in this kind of context. And that was the very, very end of March, which you might remember. What's interesting is that the first week of April had a great word that came from pop culture, from the world of The Voice, if you know that TV show on NBC.
Mm-hmm.
And Shakira used a very good, interesting word to describe the singing voice of one of the contestants. She said, "Your voice is so diaphanous." Mm. And diaphanous means characterized by extreme delicacy. It means ethereal, you know, very light. And originally it meant able to be to see through something.
That's what I thought.
Seen through. Right.
Like
it's typically a
material, clothing, something.
Like clothing, like silk, like exactly, any kind of material. And it has spread over to be also an auditory term for a light texture to sound. And it comes from the Greek word that means to show through. So obviously, originally it meant that original sense, which was referring mostly to fabrics. But it's interesting to think that Shakira is a person who didn't even speak English until she was over 20 years old, and here she is using a wonderful, giving a vocabulary lesson to the to the country with the word diaphanous, which comes from that neat Greek root. But unfortunately, the following week was not only tax day, but it was also April 15th, the day of the Boston Marathon bombings. And I'm from Boston myself, and here at Merriam-Webster, we're based in Massachusetts, to the west of Boston. But this was a very, obviously, a tragic event that touched so many people. And the word of the week that people looked up was surreal. And we have a great definition of surreal. It's marked by the intense, irrational reality of a dream. What a great definition. And this was the same word that was looked up after the 9/11 attacks.
Interesting.
So it gives you an idea of the way people think following this kind of event that really defies description.
I love this, that you get to kind of get a pulse on what, because you're worldwide, obviously, but do you know where the searches are coming from North America, say, or America?
Yes, we do. We can identify where they're from. For the homepage at Merriam-Webster.com, it's absolutely international, but it's overwhelmingly American.
Okay.
And what's interesting is that, you know, here's the interesting part as a consequence of having a dictionary online, of course, people are getting their news online. What's interesting to me is the number of folks who wrote to me about the Boston Marathon bombings from abroad, from France, from Korea, my friends in Japan. You know, people were following this news worldwide. It was a worldwide news story. So what's interesting is that we definitely are the American dictionary. We're the traditional American dictionary. We're the oldest American dictionary. But we do have this worldwide reach because of the Internet. And what's interesting to think about is the language of the Internet is really American English.
Mm-hmm.
So the following week, we're now up to April 19th. The word was a happier word. The word was ethereal, which means celestial or heavenly or marked by unusual delicacy or refinement. It was used to you might remember this, to describe the photograph that NASA released of the Horsehead Nebula that was a photograph taken by the Hubble Space Telescope to mark its anniversary. And it's this beautiful picture of a space cloud. And the word ethereal was used in the headlines everywhere to describe this image, and it was a word that everyone then looked up in the dictionary.
Fascinating.
I'm sorry?
It's fascinating to think that there's so many of us that have similar impulses.
Well, and you know what's interesting is that some of those impulses, like ethereal or a word like diaphanous, these are really vocabulary words, aren't they? They're kind of like SAT words. sometimes we find that people look up very common words. Like, for example, during the presidential debates, the word debate and even the word moderator were looked up a lot, usually around the beginning of the debate. People were settling in, and what we now know, of course, about people's behaviors, you might watch the debate on TV, but you've got your laptop open. And we can also follow other kinds of behavior. It's amusing for us to see that late at night, around 11 p.m., we can see that the lookups from our mobile devices, that is to say smartphones, iPhones, and Blackberries, they are usually of the word chi, that is to say the word Q-I, the short two-letter word that's often used in Scrabble. And so we can see what people are doing at 11 o'clock at night, which is they might be in a bar or they might be in bed, but they're playing words with friends or they're playing Scrabble and they're looking up Scrabble words. In fact, on Christmas afternoon, the two most looked up words were chi, Q-I, and za, Z-A, short for pizza. Mm-hmm. And we could tell that the whole country was playing Scrabble on Christmas afternoon. Anyway, to bring us up to May 1st, this is kind of a funny story. It's an East Coast story. The word was abattoir, which means, it's a fancy word for slaughterhouse. And it comes from the French word, which means to kill or to knock down. And what's interesting about this is it was used in a New York Times story, and often we'll see this in a big newspaper like the LA Times or the Washington Post or the New York Times. If a word is used prominently, it suddenly drives traffic to the website. In this case, it was a piece in the style section that was making fun of the Brooklyn hipster culture that focuses on locally sourced materials and flannel shirts and fixed gear bicycles and beards and earrings. And it was kind of a piece that was making fun of that culture. And in the piece, the author said that he took a do-it-yourself butchering class. And in the class, he told the other members of the class that he was going to turn his spare guest room into an abattoir. And everybody apparently took him seriously, but it's hard to know if he was kidding or not. But what's interesting is that because it was a fun article, because it was forwarded many times, and because it prompted a debate about making fun of hipsters or what is a hipster or, you know, any number of conversations, this word spiked and stayed high for 3 or 4 days. It was one of the most looked up words of the whole week last week.
And what is a hipster? Is it a demographic?
Exactly. I mean, the fact is, a hipster always, one part of the definition of hipster always seems to mean that it's somebody else.
Yes.
But it's usually understood in the New York Times style section to refer to a young person who has an interest in the arts, who has an interest in locally sourced materials, handmade goods, and falls into a category of aesthetics that you might say is outside of the pop mainstream, but has become in its own way something to make fun of, maybe a little kind of minor mainstream itself.
So like 25 to 45 or?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. And if you go into New York, absolutely up to 45, I would say. But you know the types with the beards and the flannel shirts and the thick rimmed glasses,
mm-hmm,
and the fixed gear bicycles. And the fact is, I hate to generalize about anything, but the fact is we do as human beings, we categorize people, we categorize ideas. And this is a word that people use. And what's interesting is the people who most conform to these descriptions that I've just given are the people who most object to that name.
Interesting. They don't want to be labeled.
But nobody does.
No.
You know, nobody does. So that I can understand.
Now, when you say the highest word searched, what are you talking about in terms of numbers?
You know, it's hard to say because it can be, when we're talking about 140 or so million page views per month, so you divide that by four and you're getting, maybe 30 to 40 million page views per week. But then we have what we might call a long tail, a lot of entries in that dictionary, 170,000. And so if you think of, for example, the books on Amazon.com, the bestseller probably sells 10 times a second, but the worst seller probably sells once every 10 years. And so that's how you look at the dictionary. Some words are never looked up, and some words are looked up frequently. So the top words that are looked up thousands of times per hour, and then hour upon hour upon hour, those numbers accumulate.
Interesting. So you're certainly not talking about a small sampling.
Nope, not. I mean, the only time a small sampling can make a dent that we notice would be, for example, early dawn when no one's online. and weekends when most business and school lookups are suppressed because people aren't at their offices. So we do see dips in the numbers on, for example, Sundays are much lower numbers than Mondays. Mondays are enormous numbers because people come to work, they catch up on the news, and they use the dictionary. And that's one thing that's good news is that because of our apps, we have, by the way, this dictionary is a free app for your iPhone or Android, and because of the online dictionary, we know that people are actually using the dictionary more than ever. They're using it at home, maybe as a print book, maybe in their pocket as an app, and then at their desktop at work as a website. So, and to be honest, that's the way I use the dictionary, all three ways.
Wow. Peter, thank you so much. It's so great to be back in touch with you. I look forward to visiting with you next month.
Well, it's great to hear your voice. I'm thrilled to hear you, and I'll talk to you soon.
Excellent. Peter Sokolowski, he is the editor with Merriam-Webster.com. This is Maria Sanchez. Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to visiting with you tomorrow. Tomorrow, we've got a duck expert on the program, and I'll tell you why.
Thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Live every weekday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, and on the net at LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com.